Killing Thatcher, the IRA, the manhunt, and the long war on the Crowns. The gripping account of how the IRA came astonishingly close to killing Margaret Thatcher in 1984. It's the new book by Rory Carroll, veteran journalist. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Rory himself. Rory, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jonathan.
Thanks for joining me this morning. It seems, blimey, almost 40 years ago since we woke up to the news that the Grand in Brighton had been bombed whilst the Conservative Party conference was there. Four people, I believe, were killed, if I remember correctly, but the Prime Minister survived the attack. What was the reason behind you sort of putting this all down and chronicling it?
Well, I stumbled across the story again in my day job for The Guardian, as I cover Ireland for The Guardian, and I'm always looking for interesting stories. And it turned out that a few years ago, the bomber, Patrick McGee, the man who planted the bomb, was preparing to write a memoir. And I thought that would make an interesting story for The Guardian. So I planned to interview him, read his memoir. But in researching that and eventually reading his memoir, which is very interesting about his life, his boyhood, but didn't really reveal any operational details about the Brighton plot. But in reading around it, I discovered there was an astonishing story there, and one that I thought had been familiar. I mean, I grew up, I was 12 years old when the bomb went off. I remembered the footage of Norman Tebbit being dragged out. And I thought, well, we all kind of know what happened. But in reading around it, I discovered that actually, well, two things. One, there's an amazing tale about why they went after Thatcher, how they came so close, the fact that she almost really died, and then the subsequent police hunt for the bombers, the whole police procedural part. And this was completely unknown to me, and it was a brilliant time to do this story because enough time has passed that a lot of, for example, some IRA operators plus the police who are hunting them now feel comfortable enough to talk about it. And they're also still alive. So, you know, this is the best time to do this mix of journalism and history.
You mentioned, you know, the IRA almost got Thatcher. Did they target Thatcher with sort of, if you like, particular animosity, particular relish because of her sort of uncompromising stance towards what was happening in the province?
Yes, they did. It was because in 1981, she was on deck as Prime Minister when 10 Irish Republican prisoners starved themselves to death, seeking political status in the Mays prison. And this launched her into the whole kind of demonology of Irish Republican history. She became on par with Oliver Cromwell from the 17th century. And, you know, she was considered this, enemy number one of the whole movement. And so a lot of the plot was actually driven by a desire for revenge. They wanted to avenge their 10 martyrs, starting with Bobby Sands. And in fact, the title of the American version of the book, There Will Be Fire, is taken from a warning in the IRA newspaper on Fublocked that as Bobby Sands, the first hunger striker, lay on his deathbed, they said, there will be fire, if he dies. And that was a warning to Thatcher. And of course, he did die. And sure enough, 4 years later, the Brighton bomb went off. So it was definitely personal, but it was also an attempt to change the strategic calculus of the Troubles. We had reached a stalemate and they wanted to kind of to mix things up and to see if somehow this an epochal making attack could maybe kind of change, scramble the whole Troubles.
And I mean, people sort of look back at the 80s in some sort of rose-colored way, but it was a particularly sort of brutal time. And from that sort of late, especially in Northern Ireland, but you know, that whole period from the sort of the mid to late 70s, we had the bombings, we had the shootings, we had, of course, the fatal attack on Mountbatten, off the Republic's coast on his small boat. So there really was a particularly brutal time as well.
Yes, no, it was horrible, and it's too easy to forget it. And I noticed, you know, especially for younger people whom I often interview in Ireland, North and South, and in Britain about the Troubles, people have forgotten just how grisly, how awful it was. And I mean, this story, and it does shine a light on that because it kind of takes us through really from actually Mountbatten, because Thatcher had just become prime minister when Mountbatten was killed, and it kind of brought her into the Troubles. And we see, you know, we follow in the book the trajectory of a handful of of protagonists, characters. One is the bomber, one is Margaret Thatcher herself, and then also the police who were then brought in and hunting the bomber. So, and we see how they all intersect and their own different worldviews and perspectives on this, and how, for example, one of the police bomb disposal experts, he'd lost one of his best mates, was also a bomb disposal guy, in a bomb attack in London. Mm. It's a very graphic scene of what happens when somebody is blown up in a bomb. And likewise in Brighton, in fact, it was eventually five people lost their lives there. And it was horrendous. And yet it was also very, in a storytelling sense, is also very just dramatic and compelling what happened, and especially the fact that in the end, we have this kind of manhunt where different elements of the police investigation kind of coalesce, and it ends up in a very dramatic climax in Scotland. And I don't want to give too much away,
but not.
It's a Spanish twist to this. Oh. I know you guys are in Spain, which is that after the Brighton bomber appeared to have got away with the bomb, the police knew who he was, but they didn't know where he was or what he was doing. And it turned out what he was doing, this is 8 months after the Brighton bomb, 1985, he's in Britain, based in Scotland, but preparing to launch a wave of attacks against English seaside resorts and tourist hotels in London. And this is inspired, to use that term, by the IRA, by ETA. During the Basque ETA campaign in the 1970s and 80s, they routinely targeted Spain's tourism industry with bombs in seaside resorts. And the Brighton bomber was trying to replicate that. And so there's this all these different elements and threads that come together in this story. So my job really was to do justice to it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at the huge security there are now at any sort of political event, it is quite overwhelming. And 1984, the conference, Conservative Party conference in Brighton, presumably the Conservative Party thought they were safe. And, the IRA had launched bombing campaigns in the UK at the heart of government, the assassination of Éire Nive, for example, in 79, in the car park of the House of Commons. But was it just lax discipline? They didn't think that they were going to get hit or an attack, that the IRA wouldn't be as brazen as to try and blow up the Prime Minister?
It was a failure of imagination, really, because no one had attempted to wipe out the entire government since Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot of 1605. No one simply had a kind of the audacity to even conceive on that level. Yes, Éire Nive, an MP, had been killed by a bomb, Lord Mountbatten, but they were, in a sense, relatively soft targets. They were not in government at the time. And whereas Thatcher was a prime minister, the Iron Lady, and most of her cabinet was in the Grand Hotel in Brighton. And the security forces, they were aware that the IRA had the technology. They were using timers from video recorders, VCRs, which they could plant a bomb months in advance of a VIP visit. So in one sense, the security forces kind of knew the capacity, but nobody kind of joined up the dots. And as it turned out, that week in Brighton, the main concern of the police was not the IRA, but miners. This was the time of the striking miners. And so the police flooded Brighton with police, but they were all outside the hotel looking outwards, waiting for an invasion of miners, which in fact never happened, as opposed to actually doing a thorough search inside the hotel for the ticking bomb.
Patrick McGee, because again, we tend to, and this is probably a British mainland perspective, but we tend to view the members of the IRA as almost faceless, as almost sort of identikit. But obviously each one has a story. What was Patrick McGee's?
He had a especially interesting story in that, he was from West Belfast, a Catholic working class boy, as so many other IRA members were. But he also then grew up in England. His dad moved to Norwich for work when McGee was just a young boy. And so he grew up into adolescence there in England with an English accent called Paddy or Pat. And But he'd never fully settled there, and he'd always missed his extended family, the sights and sounds of Belfast. That was his milieu, his home. And so he's always kind of a fish out of water in England, even though he had plenty of English friends. But he got into trouble in Norwich. He was, in fact, he was arrested breaking into a butcher shop, kind of steal some money. And this was in 1967 when he was, I think, like 15 years old. And again, not to give too much away in the story, but faithfully, he was fingerprinted by the Norwich police at that time as a teenager. Now, this would come back decades later to play a key role in this. But he was lost, and he's a very softly spoken man. And I mean, he eventually, when he joined the IRA, he chose to become a bomb maker, which was a very perilous undertaking. There was not a big queue within the IRA to become a bomb maker because so many blew themselves up. The explosives were unstable. The technology was often primitive. So he had courage to do it. And as an operator, that was their terminology, an operator, he was very, very, very quiet, soft-spoken, kept himself to himself. And even within the IRA circles to this day, they'll say, ah, Hat, he was a quiet one. And he still is. I mean, he's very guarded, as you kind of expect from an IRA man.
Yeah, I don't think there are many flamboyant bomb makers. It doesn't seem sort of fit the modus operandi. The attack itself. I mean, those images that came out on that morning, and as you said, Norman Tebbit being dragged from the rubble. His wife, I believe, was left permanently paralyzed, wasn't she, from the attack? And I remember Thatcher saying that, you know, she at one point she broke down because the quote was, "This was the morning that I wasn't supposed to see," or something. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, that's right. It's an excellent memory. It was the following Sunday when she was at Mass with her husband Dennis, and she saw the sunlight streaming through the window, you know, and sunbeams coming through into the pews, and that's when it hit her that she almost died, and that they had come after her, and that they really wanted to kill her, and they might try again, and that's when it struck her. And in many ways, I mean, Brighton was her finest moment, because she gave a bravura performance of defiance. I mean, hours after the bombing, whilst there were still bodies in the rubble next door, she was in the conference center going ahead with the conference. She insisted that this happen and gave a very defiant speech against the IRA. And really, even those who loathed Thatcher had to give her credit for that. I mean, that took courage and composure, which she had in bucket loads. But it did affect her, the bombing. I mean, she, for example, started carrying a torch in her handbag, a little torch, because she became concerned at nighttime, especially when she was traveling away from Downing Street, that, you know, something might happen and the lights would all go out. Also, she wanted, in bedrooms, she preferred to have the door stay open or stay ajar, again, in case something would happen, like the walls would cave in or the ceiling would collapse. You know, and it was kind of a very human, nervous reaction to that. And then you mentioned Norman Tebbit. He was on track to be her heir. I mean, he was, you know, her the most kind of Thatcherite of her ministers, extremely popular with the grassroots, and he could have become prime minister. But the Brighton bombing prevented that, because he himself was much more grievously injured than he kind of publicly let on. And then his wife, Margaret Tebbit, became a paraplegic. And to take care of her, he, in a quite a beautiful love story, he actually then abandoned frontline politics to focus on caring for his wife. And so he became the prime minister that Britain never had.
Mm. Did it... Was the bombing a success? Can you say? I mean, okay, they didn't have the primary aim of killing the prime minister, but in terms of gaining international exposure and saying, look, we're absolutely serious and you need to speak to us, was it a success for the IRA, or did it have that backlash and Thatcher becomes hardened? She's like, right, I'm going to get these people, not the words I'm sure she used, and you know, because these things can sometimes backfire and have negative publicity. Presumably, you know, in IRA enclaves, there must have been a certain amount of celebration because they'd hit such a spectacular target.
Oh, there were celebrations. I mean, I spoke to one man, he was a prisoner in the Mays prison when the news came through. And he said the cheers erupted across the wings. And, you know, they were delighted, but also disappointed because they had missed the prime goal, which was to assassinate Thatcher and wipe out her government. So they were delighted that they had got so close, had shocked the government and all of Britain and the world, because Thatcher at that time, I mean, she was one of a trio of world leaders, along with Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, she was a Cold War, you know, icon. And the fact that they came so close, and the book explains this, that, I mean, she was yards from death, from being entombed in that hotel. So for the IRA, it was a deep ambivalence about this. Because several things were happening around this time. Also, Gerry Adams was kind of edging towards what would become known as the peace process. I mean, it didn't have that name then, but he was already had spied a political path for the movement, whilst the militarists of the Provost, I mean, the ultra-militarists, wanted to continue. And they were, in a sense, emboldened by the Brighton bomb. It's like, look, we can do spectacular operations, to use their terminology, in England. This is what's going to, you know, rattle the Brits. We need to do more of this. And arguably the bombs, the Canary Wharf bombing of the 1990s were, in a sense, the heirs of the Brighton bombing, the IRA felt that it was worth investing the immense time and resources in exporting the conflict to England. And so in that sense, it emboldened them.
And presumably a huge police man. I mean, I wouldn't have fancied being the chief constable of anywhere at this point, but a huge manhunt then swung into operation after this one, because obviously, you know, the Conservatives would have, the government would have got hold of the police station, saying, well, whoever this is, we want this man more than anybody else on the planet.
Yes, it was. It was possibly the biggest manhunt in UK history. And yet what struck me fascinating when doing the research on this was, okay, you read a big manhunt, thousands of police, detectives and so on. But it also just boils down to a handful of individuals. In this case, the man leading the manhunt was a Sussex copper called Jack Rees, who was on the verge of retirement. And he's a provincial policeman. I mean, the Scotland Yard did not take the lead on this. There was no equivalent of the FBI. It was Sussex County because it happened on their patch, Brighton. And so the head of their of CID was the guy on his shoulders. And he was about to retire. So just like in some TV series, I mean, he kind of, you know, takes this one last case. And he had no experience of the IRA, no experience of bombings. I mean, he was used to getting, you know, chasing burglars or and so on. And so the story follows his role. I mean, how on earth did he cope? How did he, you know, how did that work? And of course, Scotland Yard were advising him. So, you know, we follow the paths of these policemen like him who had to, you know, start dig through the rubble, because initially they had nothing. I mean, they had no intelligence on who had done this. And so they, you know, but they got several breaks. One was that they, from the rubble, they found the registration cards of guests, and they looked back and they saw that 3 weeks earlier there was a particular reason why some of the registration cards got their attention, and they started trying to get fingerprinting things. But from really basic levels of clues, they had to build this huge case.
When you come to interview these people after sort of 40 years, is it a case of age having mellowed some of them, or are they still as cling on to their views as they did? Is the shock, is the commitment still there, or some of them looking back now after we've had the Good Friday Agreement, even though things are interesting now, shall we say, at this particular stage in the history of the island of Ireland, you know, is it quite, what's it like to interview people who were at the sharp end, Rory?
It's, you get really varied responses. I interviewed Michael Hayes. He was an IRA commander who, one of the IRA commanders who had sent Patrick McGee, the bomber, over to England. And he is, he wants recognition for his part in the Irish liberation struggle. He feels that it was he played a heroic role in a noble conflict, and he wants, in a sense, to be recognized for it, for his own contribution. And it's not there's not much real remorse there at all. Whereas Patrick McGee himself, I interviewed him for an article in The Guardian before launching into the book, And he is remorseful about the pain and suffering that he inflicted. And in fact, he has since been released from prison in 1999 under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. He has struck up a remarkable friendship with Jo Berry, and she is the daughter of the MP who died, of Anthony Berry, who died in the bombing. So he murdered her father. And yeah, they've become struck up this over 20 years, a friendship that of, you know, trying to build on reconciliation. And yet McGee still defends the Brighton bombing as a legitimate kind of act of war, because, you know, the IRA had devised this asymmetrical warfare against in the British state. And so, you know, he's a bit like Hamlet. It's like, you know, he's very conflicted about sorry, not sorry. So he occupies a very moral kind of gray area, whereas other IRA men I spoke to, some have said, look, you know, given what we got, the Good Friday Agreement, that didn't justify any of the killing. It was a complete mistake. It was a disaster. We should never have gone there. Others, like Michael, Michael Hayes, basically thinks it was a heroic struggle. So you get a whole spectrum of opinions.
The book is called Killing Thatcher, The IRA, The Manhunt and the Long War on the Crown. It's by Rory Carroll, who we're speaking to today. Rory, I'm going to run out of time because I could have spoken to you for another half an hour at least on this one. But where can people find more information about the book and about you? Because I know you're on the social medias, etc.
I'm on Twitter, although I'm very boring on Twitter. I kind of but I'm at Rory Carroll 72. But all good bookshops, you can obviously get it online, Amazon, HarperCollins, and, you know, please do. I hope people read it and give me feedback.
And you'll be able to order it as well from our own virtual bookstore there, Rory, so they can download it after this interview. Okay.
Radio Europe, let them get their...
The book is called Killing Thatcher, The IRA, The Manhunt and the Long War on the Crown. It's by Rory Carroll. Rory, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Jazz.